Welcome to the relaunch of the R Squared podcast. If you're listening for the first time, this is a basketball analytics themed podcast that I started at Hickory High last year, recorded very sporadically. But with the transition to the HP Basketball Network and the launch of Nylon Calculus, I'm hoping that this can be a regular feature during the season. So I'm excited to get things started again, and we have our first guest today, Seth Partnow. He's here to talk about his true usage statistics, descriptive versus evaluative statistics, and a whole bunch of other things. All right, how you doing tonight, Seth?
Doing pretty good, or this afternoon, really, for me, but sure.
Yeah, you're way, way, way out there on the coast in Alaska, but I appreciate you stopping and taking the time, over the past couple of days, you've sort of rolled some stuff out at Nylon Calculus, the statistics, sort of a package of statistics you've been working on, built around a number called true usage, and I really wanted to have you on the show for this relaunch of the R Squared. And really, you know, start by digging into that. Maybe just for people who haven't encountered the stat yet or haven't read your posts on it, I was wondering if you could sort of give us the setup for the stat and how you put it together.
Sure. So basically, one of the more, to my mind, interesting things that came out of the SportView data last year on NBA.com was the assist chance, which I've kind of started to call the potential assist, basically, you know, a pass that leads to a teammate's scoring attempt. And kind of assists have always been sort of a problematic stat, analytically speaking, because, you know, again, you get to that problem of assigning credit. You know, what was the, if you kick the ball out to a three-point shooter and he makes a shot, how much of that was the passer? How much of that was the shooter? On the same thing on like an alley-oop. If a guy can, you know, touch the top of the backboard and catches the alley-oop and dunks it, is it his skill for having that athleticism, or is it the guy who threw the lob? And even more problematic was the fact that, you know, there's this kind of some notorious stories about the hometown assists being awarded where, you know, a guy throws a pass and his teammate takes three dribbles, goes up and under, shoots a layup over four guys, and they somehow in the box score ends up with an assist on the play. So it's always been a problematic stat, especially because we didn't know you have any sort of, you know, attempts for that. It was just, you know, it'd be like if you were judging a player's scoring efficiency just on shots made without knowing how many he took.
Yeah.
And so that kind of, I first started noodling a lot around trying to figure out if there was a way to figure out, you know, some sort of efficiency for passing. And then from there, I realized that we could actually describe a little bit differently how a basketball possession happens because of those things I just talked about, who used the possession. That question is almost somewhat artificial because the box score sort of requires us to have one person having used that possession. Traditionally, it's been the shooter. Well, what if we said, well, actually, these two players collectively influence that possession, mm-hmm. so that, you know, you can end up using quote unquote more than 100% of possessions, because, you know, two or sometimes even three players can be involved with whatever happens. And that's kind of a different way to look at what can be an intensely cooperative process of producing mm-hmm. a shot on the basketball floor. So that's a long-winded way of that's kind of the genesis of it.
Go ahead.
No, to measure the you know the shape and size of a player's offensive contribution, allowing one or more teammates to kind of use the same possession amongst themselves rather than saying you and only you did that.
So when we look at this true usage number, and you sort of have all these component stats that go with it that sort of lend context to it, but when you look at that true usage stat, what is that? It's expressed as a percentage, sort of like a regular usage percentage. But yeah. What is contained in true usage percentage?
That's, I mean, it's a percentage. It's an estimate, a pretty close estimate of the percentage of possessions of players on the floor that he contributes either by shooting or drawing a shooting foul, turning the ball over or creating an assist chance, or I'd start not necessarily creating an assist chance, but being awarded an assist chance by SportView. So again, if on the some of the higher point guards are up over 50%, that means on more than half of their team's possessions while they're on the floor, they're either shooting or throwing the pass that leads to the shot, more or less.
And because it's SportView, when we talk about assist chances, we're talking about also like free throw assists and secondary assists, right, where you pass to a guy who passes to a guy.
Actually, in the final version, I decided to not use secondary assists,
Oh,
I
okay.
believe. I'd have to go back and recheck the formula. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
I've played around with it both ways, but it changes the number very slightly just because there are, the secondary assists are actually, I think the league leader averaged around two per game, so it's not a whole ton of them that happen. So it would make a minor difference either way, but it can be done either way, and changing between the two is fairly trivial.
Gotcha. So I know one of the things that's new about this for some people and can be kind of messy when you sort of think about the how we've thought about usage percentage before, which is that it always sums to 100%. So, if there's 100 possessions, there's five players on the floor. Those five players somehow their totals are going to add up to 100%. And so this, because there's crossover and overlap, it can be sort of or it can be maybe a little bit messy. Would that be a fair assessment looking at the individual numbers?
I don't know about messy. I think just you the again, we're explicitly relaxing the assumption that it sums to 100. So the fact that, I think that's actually somewhat elegant. If, a team's a lineup's true usage sums to, 160%, that means that on average 1.6 players is involved with every kind of shot attempt, which might it, I think it tells us something. I don't think we know enough yet to say exactly what it tells us. I think it describes their offense rather than, something I think we'll get into later. It's descriptive rather than saying that's good or bad. It's just saying that's what happened.
So I know you have had these stats for at least part of last season, and so you've sort of had some time to play with them and look at them and different things. So I know one of the really interesting things that has come out of it is the idea of true turnover percentage, that when we look at when we look at traditional turnover percentage, it's turnovers as a ratio of possessions used, which would be turnovers, shots and trips to the free throw line. So, theoretically a guy could lower his turnover percentage by just shooting more. And so you have this true turnover percentage, which has revealed some interesting things about a few high usage guys.
Specifically, guys that come to kind of the top of my mind are Chris Paul, Mike Conley, Dirk Nowitzki, and LaMarcus Aldridge, where even taking into account, or especially taking into account their the amount of offense they use, whether it's shooting or passing, they have phenomenally low turnover rates relative to doing something with the ball. And I think that that's, I'm not saying that traditional turnover rate is useless, but it's, as you pointed out, it's very contextual in that, it tends to reward chuckers at the expense of playmakers. Because if, like, for example, Steve Nash always had a pretty high traditional turnover rate, but under what system is it really accurate to say that he was, profligate with the ball? That doesn't really match up with what's actually happening on the floor, I don't think. And we don't have these numbers to go back to kind of some of his MVP seasons. I've kind of tried to mock up what they might look like, but it's not totally possible to do. But I mean, it I think would have given a much more accurate representation of exactly how skillful he was in terms of orchestrating an offense and getting teammate shots while, for the amount that he was doing, not actually turning the ball over very much.
Yeah, so I mean, so maybe like for people who are following along, like a good way to think about it is like the traditional turnover percentage is turnovers as a ratio of individual scoring chances, whereas the true
Right.
turnover percentage that you're talking about is turnovers as a rate of sort of a more robust measure of offensive involvement because it includes passes.
Absolutely. And that's and I think that that's a I think that's the one thing that's the biggest, I would say, step forward, if I can be so bold in all this, is again, measuring, turnovers more accurately as again, as a ratio of a player's ambition on offense, whether it's scoring or passing.
So you had written a piece for us, and you had looked at the true usage numbers for a few different teams. You had looked at Miami, San Antonio, and I think the Thunder was the third team, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about, like, I know Miami specifically I mean, obviously they're an enormous hole without LeBron anyway, but it seemed even more drastic when you looked at those true usage numbers.
I mean, yes, LeBron was off. This is a stat, true usage in terms of the largest proportion of offense used. Point guards far and away dominated, or were the highest amongst all teams, which kind of matches with our, understanding that point guards have the ball more, they orchestrate offense. In some ways, the kind of the positional averages confirm some of those bits of conventional wisdom about what different positions and stuff do on the floor. But LeBron was by a decent margin the highest non-point guard in terms of the total amount of offensive load he was carrying, and was carrying, unsurprisingly, I think, a much larger load than, the Heat's point guards, the Heat's titular point guards were in Chalmers and Cole. So that's a lot to make up for. Just in terms, not only his scoring, but his playmaking. Now, interestingly, I think that Luol Deng is a guy who can, make up for some of that, as can Josh McRoberts, who are both guys who were Deng certainly in Chicago, if not in Cleveland last year, was a guy who took on a pretty big load for his position, and McRoberts was one of the more, I guess, assist happy big men in the league in terms of generating shooting chances from kind of the four spot.
Gotcha. I found those numbers really interesting, and I hadn't thought about sort of plugging in those next pieces. But yeah, McRoberts' numbers look really interesting on here. And then, so if you want to just take a second and compare that to what you found with the Spurs, because I think that was one of the that 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 comparison between those two rosters, I thought was sort of the crux of that piece, or the most interesting piece.
Well, again, the Spurs, matching up with some of our intuition about them, were a team that shared the ball a lot amongst a lot of different guys. Did the only guy who was surprisingly high, I think, was Ginobili, and that's actually not that surprising because he comes in the game and basically handled the ball and ran every possession, it seemed like, when he came in the game. But other than that, they were definitely a more, I would say, balanced, and that's there's been so much talk about how, the Spurs playing the right way and stuff. I don't want that to sound like, that's a descriptive judgment rather than a normative one, that, they were playing better. It's just they were playing in a way that, the ball moved and generated a lot of assist chances, and so that showed up in the balance that their lineups had, and in terms of the number of players involved in each kind of play.
So I know there's some limitations with these stacks and with these stats and with the calculations, because some of it comes from SportView, and so we're limited to we're limited by the data that they make public. But it seems like the sort of natural evolution of this is, I mean, you started by looking at the true usage numbers by roster, but it seems like the natural evolution then is to actually start looking at the overlap in true usage when you have specific lineups on the floor. And that's probably outside the realm of possibilities right now, because we don't have play-by-play data with these specific sport view stats. But is that where you see this too, or sort of where you see some of the sort of the penultimate value?
I think that's something that would be the next step if you know the public had access to the full database. Whether or not this kind of analysis is the kind of thing that's useful to a team with the more information they have, I don't know. It's something that's certainly doable. How useful it becomes if you have kind of better measures, I mean, I don't want to make any claims about that just because I haven't seen, you know, what else is out there that's, mm-hmm. that's better in terms of the data coming in. But at this point, it's stuff that's interesting from a narrative and fan standpoint. I don't think we have enough data with it yet to say it's that much of a tool for evaluating mm-hmm. players. Though again, if you're looking for, a wing who can handle the ball a little and create for teammates a little, then maybe it can help identify those kind of players. But I think that, you know, other methods could probably do that pretty well too with the resources at the disposal of a team.
It's actually a nice segue because one of the other things that we had on our agenda for tonight was talking about the idea of different types of statistics, and you and I have had a couple different conversations about this. You've certainly been on the record with a preference for a certain type of statistic, and then I wrote something about this last week, but I think you and I both sort of think about statistics in categories, that there are things that are evaluative where you're trying to measure how good a player is. There are things that are descriptive where you're trying to get at the style of a player's contributions on the floor. Then there's things there are things that are maybe predictive where you're trying to project out in the future. And then there are things that are narrative, where you're more focused on telling the story than sort of any of those other elements. And it seems like this is sort of a panacea of descriptive statistics.
Yeah, I think so. And I guess I've expressed an interest in descriptive statistics. Not that I think
a preference is not the right word, but maybe find those more intriguing.
I wish they were given more emphasis than I think we are often in a rush to just say who's best, mm-hmm. who's worst, compare these two guys. And in doing so, and, you know, a lot of various, adjusted plus minus stuff, it's interesting and useful and certainly rigorous and good statistics. I feel like we're oftentimes skipping a step, mm-hmm. We want to go straight to how well is everyone doing before we fully understand what's being done. And I think something we've talked about offline a little bit also is, I think that's part of a lot of the baseline stuff kind of has been ported from an understanding of baseball, been influenced by kind of the early like sabermetric or sabermetric Brett Saberhagen, baseball statistics, and that intermediary step of determining what is attempted, how a player is doing something, might not be super necessary in baseball because at risk of being slightly reductive about baseball, which I think is a sport I grew up loving, and don't mean this to be demeaning, but it's the fundamental confrontation of a game of baseball is pitcher and batter, and it's relatively easy to assign everything that happens right there, and there isn't a lot more strategy going on than see ball, hit ball. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get nasty emails. I know there's a lot going on in terms of trying to, fool the batter and stuff like that, but I'm talking from an analytical standpoint. Whereas, in basketball with the five offensive players, five defensive players, interchanging positions in kind of a dynamic situation, mm-hmm. What you're trying to do is different. In baseball, everyone gets their turn and they hit. In basketball, shots don't just happen. They have to be generated somehow. And in kind of skipping the step of describing in some way how that happens, I feel like we often lose something. I mean, the Morey ball philosophy of shoot threes and layups. Well, mm-hmm. that's great if you could just choose to shoot threes and layups, Teams would be stupid not to do that. But I think everyone understands at an intuitive level that partially because there's a defense out there, but it doesn't just work that simply.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether, you know, changing your offensive attack to try to generate those looks more often would be better. That's a fair question. But then we're suddenly not really in the realm of analytics anymore. We're now talking strategy and tactics.
Mm-hmm.
But the analytics that can inform that discussion are kind of these descriptive statistics of what guys are actually doing in a slightly more detailed way than just, you know, field goal attempts and shot charts.
Yeah. And so, the question I had while you were talking, and I grew up with baseball as well. I was a big baseball fan, but I definitely sort of parted ways with baseball before sabermetrics became big. And so I definitely don't know baseball statistics very well. But my very general sense is that there's not necessarily as much separation between evaluative statistics and descriptive statistics in baseball. And that just in the nature of the game, it's easier to assign value to doing things a certain way than it is in basketball. I don't know if you think that's a fair statement.
I think that's, you know, I'm hardly an expert on baseball statistics, but you can argue kind of about the relative value of, you know, slugging percentage versus on base percentage or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's at you know, the base terms, I mean, it's understood that, you know, making an out is bad and getting on base is good. Mm-hmm. And any way you can do that is a good thing. So we're just, you know, assigning a value between a guy who walks and a guy who hits doubles is, you know, that's, you know, I guess that has a little bit of descriptive stuff in there, but, you know, coming up with a one number valuation of a player, you know, isn't that difficult. There's an innumerable number of systems that do that, and you can argue about the relative merits of each one, but, you know, translating stuff into, you know, scoring or preventing runs is I think much simpler than translating into scoring or preventing points in basketball.
Mm-hmm.
That's my overly long-winded way of agreeing with you, I guess.
So knowing that basketball statistics are just like just steeped in context, and that, you know, that in most cases it's sort of impossible to divorce some of these things from the context of the other players on the floor and the opposition and the players on the other team, other players on the court, the player's role, position, all of those sorts of things. As a writer, when you're using analytics in, you know, maybe not necessarily like this true usage where you're sort of introducing a new idea and a new set of a way of looking at things, but when you're maybe writing a descriptive article or a narrative article, how much do you trust the reader to understand that like, I guess, where do you draw the line in illustrating that context for the reader, knowing that you could easily spend an extra 4,000 words on everything you write, sort of fleshing that out?
That sounds like a threat to people. That I could, given the length of some of the pieces I've already written,
yeah,
there could be more. I think that's always a tough needle to thread in terms of deciding, you know, how much of the context needs to be described. And I think honestly, it depends a lot on kind of where the venue in which the piece is being published. I probably am safe to assume a different level of baseline knowledge, writing on nylon calculus, or if there isn't, then hopefully once we get kind of the glossary up and running a little bit more, I'll at least know that there's a place for people to, if I use a term that may be outside of someone's, you know, area of familiarity, they can, you know, get a quick primer on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, whereas other places, for readers who, you know, haven't, you know, explicitly decided I'm going to go read an article on an analytics focused site with all that entails, you don't want to necessarily spring something on them that, you know, all of a sudden using some very esoteric statistical model that might end up losing someone in the details of trying to figure out what the model you're doing actually says, rather mm-hmm. than the point you're trying to make.
So knowing that you sort of you're shaping your content somewhat depending on the place, you know, you write a million different places, but
too many different places, yeah.
tough to keep up with. But is there this might be an uncomfortable or an awkward question, but is there a place that feels the most natural, you know, sort of like the voice that you, or I'm thinking about the amount of sort of statistical content, but the stuff you write for Clipper blog versus the stuff you write for Nylon Calculus versus the stuff you write for Harder Paroxysm, is there a, in terms of the level of analytics, is there a voice that sort of feels most comfortable or most natural to you?
I mean, I think that I naturally, my natural tendency is to write long and then edit back.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's not necessarily a function of analytics. That's just a function of, you know, how I've always kind of written things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a former life, I was an attorney, so brevity was not necessarily rewarded.
Yeah.
Spelling things out in the minutest detail was you know, okay, and in fact encouraged,
mm-hmm.
because you didn't want to lose on a point of law because you didn't fully explain your argument or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, as far as in kind of when editing stuff back when it feels right, mm-hmm. It's kind of when it feels right, and it depends very much on the piece I'm writing, I guess. I'm sorry, I can't give you a better answer than that. But
no worries, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
It's okay. It's and I don't know how successfully I thread that needle, but
yeah.
I hope that I'm simultaneously challenging, but not to people, but not overly so, and uh-huh. to people with, you know, greater range of knowledge, not mm-hmm. not talking down to them. That's always the balance, I guess.
Well, I'm always curious about these sorts of things. I mean, we spent all this time, we were on multiple email threads every day, things are flying back and forth all the time, and we spend so much time talking about content and ideas and approaches and things like that, and I feel like very rarely do I have which is strange because you can't see I'm doing air quotes, but I'm an editor of the website.
Right.
But so rarely do we spend time sort of talking about methods and the actual writing side. You know, we talk about analytics a lot, but we don't necessarily talk about the writing side a lot and sort of how to blend those things together. So I was just curious. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
And I'm largely, I don't have any, you know, formal training in kind of, writing per se beyond, you know, the persuasive writing that you learn for, you know, law school. And I guess there's some degree of, you know, in terms of, you know, in college, if you're doing an economics paper, you have to, you know, you can't just throw a bunch of words and SPSS spreadsheets onto the page and say, done, give me an A. You have to explain what you've done and do so in a way that's, readable and won't put your audience to sleep. Mm-hmm. So I guess that in terms of training, in terms of talking, you know, rendering somewhat obtuse concepts
mm-hmm.
readable, I guess that's where my background comes in a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So not having this, you know, I'm sort of in the same boat, not having this sort of formal training with statistics or high level math or things like that. How did you, maybe I'm projecting a little bit from my own experiences, but how did you grow into the place where you felt comfortable talking about something or presenting something like true usage, something original that you created, and feeling comfortable that you sort of understand the methods and where this sort of fits into the statistical lexicon, and knowing that it has value in whatever, you know, descriptive or evaluative or whatever sort of way? How did you grow into that place?
Well, I was actually thinking about this the other day, and I've always been very kind of drawn to, you know, sports statistics and, you know, chopping and changing them and seeing what kind of, you know, numbers you could generate on your Nintendo baseball game, or with, you know, if you had the perfect season, how many home runs could one guy hit? Mm-hmm. Or, and I remembering back, I think I did my first kind of quote unquote statistical modeling when I was about 14. Uh-huh. There was a basketball game on the Amiga. And if you remember the Amiga, anyway, called TV Sports Basketball. And, uh-huh. Each player was rated on 6 categories from 1 to 8. And that's all that, you look at like the NBA, like 2K, and there's, 50 different ratings, mm-hmm. on a 100-point scale, but it was 6 categories. SPD, RQJ, I still remember that. shooting, passing, defense, rebound, quickness, jumping.
Still that simple.
Yeah. And, with the help of actually a friend of mine's dad, who was also into this kind of stuff, we mm-hmm. kind of chopped and changed and figured out a way to, the game came with, nonsense characters and stuff like that, but it also had an editor that so you could, put in, if we wanted to put the 1986 Boston Celtics in there, we'd have to figure out how you rate, 1986 Larry Bird.
And you were after realism. You were not like, Larry Bird's just 99 across the board.
Yeah, no. Even though I'm a Celtics fan, wanted realism. Although I if I remember correctly, when I did the 92 Celtics, I may have fudged on Reggie Lewis a little bit.
Yeah.
If you listen to the Over and Back podcast this week, that he's my favorite player of all time. So nothing you can say was going to make Reggie Lewis look bad.
Yeah.
And that was, it's kind of thing like, I remember a few of the formulas we used, but it was mostly just kind of like, per 48 minute stats kind of dropped into sort of tranches, and mm-hmm. therefore you could come up with this rating. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of been messing around with this stuff forever. Kind of formally, I guess I just kind of started doing it, and I'm fortunate enough to have, friends and acquaintances who, do some of this, professionally and semi-professionally, and kind of, hey, this is what I found. Does this make sense? And so I've kind of been able on some level to bounce some early versions of stuff off them, and all right, I know I'm at least not completely, out in left field here. So, mm-hmm. and kind of gone from there, and just kind of stopping at every step and say, does this answer the question that I think I'm asking? Does this metric, does this input, mm-hmm. does this, this player generated 7 assist chances. Does that, are assist chances really the thing I'm trying to measure here? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the important thing is the logic of it as much as kind of the mathematical model. I mean, you can come up with a beautiful mathematical model of anything. It's just a matter of, does the two things you're comparing, or the however many things you're comparing, what's their logical relation to each other?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're just kind of, you're, I think an article we both enjoyed recently was talking about, baseball statistics, and otherwise it's just it's an experiment on the statistics, not on the game.
Yeah. And yeah. I was just going to say that was a Jack Moore piece at the Cauldron.
Yes.
And that was something that we had talked about touching on today. And that was a line that you, we were talking about some things that we could hit tonight. You sent me that specific line, I think, that it's an experiment on a data set as opposed to the sport itself.
Yeah. And I think that in baseball, again, to make that comparison, to a large degree, everything, interesting, not everything important that happens in a baseball game is captured mm-hmm. in kind of the, if not the box score, in the score sheet,
mm-hmm.
That the same is not, I don't think that anyone would say the same was true for basketball. Maybe starting to get into it with, the Sport View and the Vantage and stuff like that. But I don't think we're far enough along in the development of any of those kind of technologies and techniques to know whether it's capturing everything correctly or everything we want to know, or maybe even capturing some things that are confusing because it's not quite capturing what they think they're capturing in the sort of charting.
And I think one of
So.
the things that was really interesting about the way Jack set that up, and we'll link to the piece in the bottom of the podcast, but I think one of the things that was really interesting to me about how he set that up is that he was saying that the sport is like fluid and it constantly changes, and something that you ran on data from 1995, you might get a different result than something that you ran on data from 2005 because the game itself is fluid and not static, and so the data represents that too.
Yeah, and I think that's, in baseball, that's kind of in the context of the steroid era. Whereas in basketball, I think that, comparing, it's difficult to compare players to from, say, 1984 to today, in large part because of the three-pointer. I mean, I think there's probably not a player who has suffered more under kind of modern analytics than Isaiah Thomas. And it's because he didn't shoot three pointers, basically, and that so he was a less efficient player. However, I mean, he was never my favorite player. His post playing career has done nothing to change my opinion of him generally. But I kind of have to think that if Isaiah Thomas in 1978 knows how important it's going to be to shoot a 23 footer. He's going to work on his 23 footer more, and that's going to become part of his game. So it's comparing what his accomplishments to what he thought, what the prevailing wisdom of the day was the correct way to play. It's kind of important to keep that in mind
It's
because.
funny to think about those things moving forward. Sorry, but sometimes where you look at Basketball Reference and they have like date ranges that you can sort of set in, and it's like the 3-point era, the shot clock era. It's not in there, but you could sort of set the when the hand check rules were changed on the perimeter is one of those too. But it's funny because it seems like we might be moving into a time and space where these sort of fundamental shifts are not coming from rule changes, they're coming from, I don't want to step out of bounds, but they're coming from analytics, things like, understanding the value of corner threes and understanding the value of free throws and all those sorts of things. That might be sort of what shapes the eras as you look back over the next whatever, next century.
I don't think that we can necessarily divorce that from rule changes, though. I think that the hand checking rule allows better drives from the perimeter, and better drives from the perimeter, creates more corner threes. I mean, I feel fairly safe in saying that. Whereas, before, in the previous rule set, maybe a post up was more valuable. Now maybe the post up was partially valuable because it could generate that corner three, but it's. I don't think there's anything inherently magical about any sort of style of play. It's just a matter of kind of the rule set and the kind of the talent of the league as a whole will determine where from an economic standpoint, it'll determine where you can find value.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. The one other thing that really jumped out of that Jack Moore piece to me was there's a paragraph at the end where he talked about how we often study a question, we look and we use the average as sort of our result. So he talked about players like Chuck Knoblauch and Albert Bell, and so even though he was talking about a study on basically the size of a media market and whether that influenced a baseball player's performance. So if you move to New York, you move to LA, does your performance sort of take a hit at, struggling to handle the media? And basically it didn't look like there was a statistical result. And he said, well, just because for the whole data set there isn't a statistical result, that doesn't mean that specific players aren't highly influenced by that. And I thought that idea was really interesting about how often we just look at the average and we forget about the people on the margins, and that they might be really influenced by different things that we see sure. as not an effect on the whole population.
Sure. I was thinking about that, and I think that in some ways, the Timberwolves last year provided sort of an example of that.
Mm-hmm.
The Timberwolves, you often hear it said that they, outperformed their record in terms of point differential and stuff like that. And
that's the kind of thing.
Underperformed, excuse yes. me. You're right. They were unlucky in terms of I'm air quoting, of course. And to some extent, they may have been a little bit unlucky, but that's what you're talking about. As in the average, teams win and lose close games at a fairly predictable rate, and most of the time, teams. The theory goes: most of the times, teams that are outside of that one way or the other have been unlucky and are likely to regress to the mean. Well, if you actually watched a lot of those Timberwolves performances, I think there were some aspects of the way they played that that made them, less likely than average to win in those situations. And that's, I think that's the exact same kind of, I don't want to say extreme, but of kind of team on the margins where the average doesn't necessarily apply.
Yeah, because, there's extenuating circumstances for their particular case, which beyond point differential, there's some other things that are influencing
right.
Their performance.
And that's almost that touches on kind of one of the subterranean, I want to say, kind of disagreements in kind of basketball analytics, which some people and this is going to be slightly reductive. some people think that the first possession of the game and the last possession of the game are the same thing, and some don't, and there are two kinds of people in this. No, I think I am of the opinion that there are differences just based on I think we can. Qualitatively watch those possessions and see that they play differently. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not that's represents kind of an irrationality on the part of a team, it's like, oh, there's 20 seconds left. Kevin Durant standing at the top of the floor, dribble for 14 seconds and then do something. Whether or not that it would be better to run the same offense you ran the first play of the game or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting question, but I think when we look at averages, we are the season long average. We're basically saying that those two things are of equal weight
mm-hmm.
in terms of determining wins and losses. And at this point, I don't think that there's any resolution as to which broad and sort of falsely dichotomized side of that the truth is.
It's interesting because one of the first years, I think it was the first year I was at Sloan, so I guess it would have been 3 years ago, there was a paper, and it was about college basketball, and it was the first time that I had seen somebody use cumulative win probability. So the idea that at different points during the game, you have a different win probability. If you're up six with 3 minutes left, your win probability is X based on, an enormous data set of teams in similar situations with similar scores dating back. And so the research he was showing, the bulk of his research was showing that basically this cumulative win probability was actually a much more effective predictor of a team's true strength than even point differential, which we have sort of moved to point differential from just wins and losses. But one of the things that was sort of hidden in there was that he had found that that possessions. I may be butchering because I don't remember the exact numbers, but basically possessions in the fourth quarter or in the last 10 minutes of the second half in college had a significantly bigger effect on cumulative win probability by virtue of that the game has a time limit and it's over at the end of 40 minutes,
right.
As long as they're not tied. And I thought that was so amazing. And the fact that, I feel like I haven't seen anybody follow up on that, and I know there's I can't pronounce the guy's last name, Mike Bioy. I'm sure I'm butchering it, but the guy who runs InPredict. So there is cumulative win probability for statistics for the NBA that are available, but I've never seen anybody follow up with some more research on that, at least at the NBA level.
Yeah, though, and then that's I think kind of based on my areas of kind of competence and interest, mm-hmm. stuff like that is interesting, but not the most interesting stuff for me. Mm-hmm. Again, getting back to, I feel like that's kind of skipping steps mm-hmm. almost in our understanding of kind of the building blocks of the game. In a way, I'm a big fan of a lot of these, you know, a lot of the plus minus and other kinds of statistics, and I'm especially a fan of them on, you know, you can do an adjusted plus minus, you know, on rebounding to see, you know, that shows that a player like Nene is even though his individual rebound totals aren't great, his team rebounds better when he's on the floor, mm-hmm. and I think those are interesting. Even controlling for opponents and teammates and stuff like that. I think those are interesting results. But on some level, that feels a little bit like, I read a lot of Michael Lewis, who, you know, of course, wrote Moneyball.
Yeah.
But a lot of his writing is in kind of financial markets. And you start talking about how, you know, when you're taking these like second and third derivatives of what's going on, you get further and further away from the thing you're actually studying. And sometimes I worry that you know, going deep down these rabbit holes, you know, are leading to interesting statistical results that I'm not sure if we know how to tie back to the game itself yet. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm, you know, even though I enjoy discussing the analytics, I'm a mild skeptic on kind of the application of some of those metrics and techniques.
Mm-hmm. And you, at the when we first launched Nylon Calculus in July, you wrote a big piece about visual spatial analytics. And you talked about some, yeah, it was enormous. Well worth the read, though. But you talked about some of those things with regard to plus minus statistics that, you know, a GM looking for a free agent power forward is not going to necessarily start with you know, trying to figure out who's the best fit for my team. They're not going to start with a plus minus statistic. That might be one thing that they're going to look at, but there are all these sort of contextual or, you know, descriptive statistics like we were talking about before, and that those are the things that might really guide the value of that player on that specific team in that context.
Right. I mean, if you're, you know, if your center protects the rim and shoots threes on offense, then, you know, you're looking for very different things out of your new power forward. Then, you know, then you can maybe a guy like Greg Monroe is a good fit for you. He's kind of a very low posts, you know, big man who isn't going to protect the rim. Well, maybe he's a guy who you can, you know, get maximum value out of. Whereas mm-hmm. if, you know, your center is a pure post up player who, you know, doesn't necessarily defend the rim very well, then you're looking for a very different, you're looking for Serge Ibaka then. Yeah.
I think what you're saying is that Greg Monroe's problem really is that Andre Drummond can't shoot three pointers. And that if he could shoot three pointers, Monroe would be fine.
Greg Monroe is a guy who's a good NBA player who's going to be difficult to build around.
I think, yeah.
In the modern game, I think is the way I describe him.
Cool. Well, I know
that's not necessarily a fault of his own, by the way. That's just, you know, it's you know, that's what he is and where the league is. And if he'd have been a player who was, you know, came into the league in the early 90s, he'd be a, you know, multi-time All-Star probably.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny too, because you look at him and it's really, he has so many skills, and there's just, it's, or at least it seems subjectively, it seems like there are just sort of a few things that separate him from really being able to thrive. Like if he could hit an 18-foot jump shot consistently, you know, if he could protect the rim a little bit better, sort of like marginal increases in those, in a few specific areas, would make everything else that he does so much more potent.
I mean, yes, exactly. And I think that ties back in a little bit with, you know, our original, the original topic of, you know, what's a GM looking for is like, well, he doesn't quite do this well enough. Doesn't quite do that well. Maybe let's look at someone else who might, in sort of an overall perspective, grayed out, you know, a little bit better. But you know, doesn't necessarily, but has the things we're looking for a little bit more. And there's no way that, that a one number metric is ever going to tell you that. Mm-hmm. You know, at a certain level, you know, you'd always take LeBron James over Andre Iguodala, no matter, you know, what you were looking for. So at a certain kind of gross level of evaluation, but you don't need a, but then again, you don't need an advanced statistical, you know, methodology to see that.
Yeah.
So when you get into the kind of the more fine, the finer details of it, that's when, you know, looking at the individual skills and how it fits in with, you know, what you have on your team and how your team is going to develop and, you know, the direction you think the league is going to move and who you have to beat in the playoffs to make the finals. I think that has to come into effect a little bit also. So being able to measure these more finite skills more exactly, is far more important than just kind of a you know, a rank order of these are the top 25 players in the NBA in this order. We shall not deviate from this list.
Well, there's plenty more to talk about, but I know you've got to run and you're very generous with your time this afternoon for you out there in Alaska. So thanks a lot for coming on. Now that the R Squared's back, we'll be sure to have you on again soon. And
I hope so.
We'll link to a bunch of Seth's stuff that we talked about on the podcast today. And yeah, thanks for coming on, Seth.
Well, thanks for having me. Nice to talk to you as always.